Good evening, everyone. Welcome and thank you for all being here tonight. My name is Professor Susan Luckman, and I'm filling in tonight for the Reverend Rob McPherson, who couldn't be here because he's suffering from an ill-timed dose of the flu, as he called it. It's the most inauspicious time he could have gotten it, not that there's any good time to get the flu. So he sends his sincerest apologies. But before we begin tonight's program, can I please remind you to turn off your mobile phones or to set them to silent? And in recognition of the fact that we meet here tonight, and those of you who are here for the conference will be meeting for the next few days on the traditional lands of the Kaurna people, we are very pleased to have Kaurna Elder, Mr. Jack Buckskin, to give a welcome to country.
All right. Firstly, you're probably thinking,
Kaurna Elder?
Look pretty young. Thanks. For those, my name is Vincent Buckskin, but everybody just calls me Jack. My whole family call me Jack. I don't know why my mum put Vincent on the birth certificate. I guess it's only Vincent when I'm in trouble, so I'll be Jack tonight. I'm a good boy. I represent three different Aboriginal groups, the Kaurna of the Adelaide Plains here, the Ngurrungur of the York Peninsula, and Wirangal of the near Streaky Bay, Sijuna area. But my dad's side is Italian, Egyptian, Scottish as well, so I acknowledge my dad through doing this because I wouldn't be here without him. But today I'm here to provide a welcome to country to my mother's side, my grandmother's side of country as well. I've become a relearner of my mother tongue language, and my grandfather was denied the opportunity when living on the reserves of mission to speak language. My mum didn't get the opportunity. She came to the city of Adelaide for the first time in 1970 when the missions closed down. So she didn't get the opportunity to speak language, and I've had to relearn it. Now I speak it to my children. My Aboriginal name though is Kaurna Pundurwit Pinakudna, which is a bit of a tongue twister, and probably Jack's a little bit easier for you to remember, but it breaks up into three smaller names, and it's quite significant because I look at your principles here and I reckon you've moulded these around Aboriginal culture, because for us, when we're talking about the, responsibility and truth of meaning, what it is for us as Aboriginal people, we all have an individual connection. So everybody is a superior, is everybody that stands alongside them, because we as individuals have our sole responsibility. My name and my totem is Kaurna the Rock. And not because the actor, the rocker, everybody gets us mixed up a lot, but it's a little bit difficult to talk about the rock because of the significance to rock in our culture. It has so many layers. I think that's more like our onion. It's a little bit more harder, but it's more like our onions. But the second part of my name, Pundurwitpina, it means the father of the dragonfly. And I've got three children. Each of those children have their own totem. My youngest is Pundurwitpina, the dragonfly. My second is Ngukko, the barking owl, and my eldest is Kuryo, the black swan. And we get our names that sort of accompany our children to help them understand their responsibility. And their responsibility is to care for their totem, because nobody else is. Everybody's got their own responsibility. So on behalf of my ancestors, I'm honored to be able to welcome you to country. And as a first person in my family to be able to do that, and then to stand here and teach people about our culture. But I'm going to go a little bit further and welcome you in our mother tongue language. And also, I'll sing a little song, but I'm going to clap and sing a little song to invite our spiritual ancestors. And what I mean by spiritual ancestors, it's not just my spiritual ancestors, but it's all of our spiritual ancestors that still live within our land to come and invite us, and invite them in to come and join us as well. So the songs that we sing connect to our spiritual world. So after introducing myself, I'll sing to invite our guests. Ramari Bindjani, Jigangani, Ngukut, and Nagulu, and Tabakanin. Yai Tanga, Wota, Kaurna, Ngurrungur, Wirangal, Miyotaka, and Bukya, Ngu, Kumpaya, Agiyato, Apendi, Natangai, Tanganyanga, Tikari, Wanga, Warigani, Yam Yama. Marwajang ngai chupuk ya na bor kana kum gan mini yala ra ngawang gan di manin pun ninga luku ya ana ya di ada ngalu tane kan ita kan di mata pun di kana kan ya ada ngetik kan di ngai chu yung ya kan ya. So on behalf of all Kaurna people, welcome here. And this one is singing the song to invite our spiritual ancestors. Welcome to country.
Thank you very much. Professor Yu Mackay, Mr. J. Buckskin, executives and members of ANJUA, members of the UCSA, honoured guests, ladies and gentlemen. In addition to this being a public lecture by one of the nation's most prominent social researchers, tonight's talk also serves as the keynote address of the biennial conference of the Australia and New Zealand Unitarian Universalist Association, a network of Unitarian and Universalist churches and fellowships around the region. Over 40 years ago, the astronomer Carl Sagan said, "There is today, in a time when all beliefs are withering, a kind of philosophical hunger, a need to know who we are and how we got here. There is an ongoing search, often unconscious, for a cosmic perspective for humanity." As a faith tradition free of creeds and dogmas, Unitarians pride themselves that they continue this search. But like most faith traditions, Unitarians too have been managing a steady decline in membership, attendance, and relevance for generations, and are thus having to think creatively about how to find a way forward in this new century. In the current context of debates about the nature and scope of religious freedom, the rise of the so-called nuns, as in N-O-N-E-S, and the seeming triumph of secularism, we continue that search for meaning. We can have faith in meaning that transcends our private selves and kindles joyful living. Professor Mackay's book, Beyond Belief, has been a salutary and most welcome contribution to this endeavour. It is a comprehensive and thorough work of social research on the current state of play in matters of faith, belief, and religion in Australia today. We are thus eager to hear what Professor Mackay has to offer tonight, as I'm sure you all are. There will be some time after the talk for some Q&A and perhaps an opportunity for book signings. If you haven't got a copy of Beyond Belief, there are copies for sale just to the side over here. Yu Mackay is a social researcher and the author of 17 books, soon I heard to be 18. He's just sent off another manuscript, 10 in the field of social psychology and ethics, and 6 novels. In recognition of his pioneering work in social research, he's been elected a Fellow of the Australian Psychological Society and awarded honorary doctorates by the Universities of Charles Sturt, Macquarie, New South Wales and Western Sydney. A newspaper columnist for over 25 years, Yu is currently an honorary professor of social science at the University of Wollongong, an adjunct professor in the Faculty of Arts at the Charles Sturt University, and a patron of the Asylum Seekers Centre. He was previously Deputy Chairman of the Australia Council, Chairman of Trustees of Sydney Grammar School, and the inaugural Chairman of the ACT Government's Community Inclusion Board. In 2015, he was appointed an officer in the Order of Australia. Would you please join me in welcoming Professor Yu Mackay?
Thank you very much, Susan, and good evening, everybody. You wouldn't think so to look around Australia, but if you lift your gaze and look around the world, it turns out that religion is actually on the rise. At the moment, as well as can be established through research of this kind, 73% of the world's population identify with one of the four great world religions, Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, and Hinduism. And the graph is climbing quite steeply. Conservative predictions are that by the middle of this century, it'll be 80% of the world's population identified with one of those religions. And incidentally, the most dramatic rises in religious faith and practice are occurring in the very countries where religion was once banned. So religion is a bit like alcohol in this. We know what prohibition did to alcohol consumption in places where it's been imposed, and parents know what prohibition does in all sorts of contexts. But certainly Russia and China in particular, the growth of religion in those two countries, banned under Stalin and under Mao, has been spectacular. China in particular. By the middle of the century, it's confidently predicted, in fact, I think this will turn out to be a very conservative prediction, that there will be more churchgoers in China than in the US, because church attendance in the US has started to fall quite markedly as well. There are, in fact, 100 million Christians in China at the moment. It is a big country, but 100 million is quite a lot of people. And it looks as there are a similar number of Muslims in China. It looks as though within the next perhaps 20 or 30 years, China will have become the world's biggest Christian country and the world's biggest Muslim country simultaneously. I wish I was going to be around to see that. So that's what's happening over there, out there, but what's happening here? The Australian picture is very much like the picture in most Western liberal democracies. It's a picture of dramatic decline in church attendance, but a very mixed bag. When you look at some other measures of the place of religion in Australian life apart from church attendance. For example, very reliable national surveys conducted in the last couple of years, 68% of Australians claim belief in God, or if they don't want to use the term God, then in some undefined higher power, 68%. In the last census, in spite of all its wobbles, we now have got some very useful material from the latest census. In the last census, 52% of Australians identified as Christian, way ahead of any other religious group. By the way, if you put Christianity together with all other religions, then about 60% of the Australian population identify with one religion or another, but 52% Christian. Now, incidentally, that's come down in the last, between the last two censuses. It's come down from 62 to 52%, which is, of course, a pretty significant drop. There are people saying we're about to be overrun by Muslims. What an outrageous proposition from every point of view, but just statistically, it's outrageous. 2.6% of the Australian population are Muslim, compared with 52% Christian, 2.5% Buddhist, 2% Hindu. In fact, our fastest growing religion is Hinduism. And it's likely within the next 10 to 15 years, Hinduism will be the number two religion in Australia, followed by Islam and Buddhism. So there's a lot of religion about, and there's a majority of Australians wishing to identify as Christian. So what do they do when it comes to going to church? And the simple answer is they don't. Only 8% of the Australian population are weekly churchgoers. If we're a little more generous and say, what about people who go reasonably regularly, say once a month or more often, it gets up to 15%. So that's a fairly substantial minority, but it's still clearly a minority. At the major Christian festivals, Christmas and Easter, it's 25% of the population attend church or some other religious, or in the case of Christmas, perhaps quasi-religious celebration. If you add in carols by candlelight in parks around the country, it's well over 30% of the population. So we're not going to church, even though we're wanting to say, yes, Christian, but we are wanting to send our kids to church schools. It's an extraordinary situation. Church attendance going through the floor, enrollment at faith-based schools or church-run schools going through the roof. In secondary schools around Australia now, about 40% of pupils are attending church-run schools. In New South Wales, it's up to about 50%. So what's that about? Well, there are plenty of historical precedents. One in particular that I attracted to, the arch-cynic Voltaire, who was famously anti-religious, specifically anti-Christian. And although that was his personal position, Voltaire declared that he nevertheless wished his wife and his tailor and his lawyer all to be Christians, because he thought then there would be less chance of being cuckolded or cheated in some way. Well, that perhaps also helps to explain why, in a very interesting piece of research from the last two or three years, a survey of non-churchgoers, 90% of non-churchgoers said they like having a church in their suburb or town. As though to say, I don't personally want to have anything to do with it, but I like to know it's there. I like to know that kind of thing is going on. I remember in my own research some years ago listening to ex-churchgoers saying how much they enjoyed seeing little groups of people gathered on the footpath outside churches on Sunday mornings, and saying quite literally, isn't it nice to know that sort of thing still happens? And there's an assumption that the people who are there, the people who are attending that church, even though in dwindling numbers, are probably good guys. Their influence in the community at large is likely to be benign, and perhaps better than benign. But nevertheless, the truth is that most Australians now simply never enter a church, unless it's been converted into an Indian restaurant or a rug showroom or something. But a church as a church, most of us don't go. We don't even go there for weddings. 70% of Australian weddings are now conducted on non-church premises. And if you've been to a wedding conducted in a park somewhere or in some secular space, you'll probably have noticed that not only are young couples preferring not to get married in church, but they're preferring not to use the traditional language. So there are these vows, usually excruciating, written by the bride and groom. Kind of makes you wish they'd go back to the traditional language. But my personal favourite was a wedding in Perth a few years ago where presumably this had all been negotiated between bride and groom beforehand, but the bride declared with a solemn look on her face, "I promise to tell you if you become boring." I'm not sure what I would have made of that if I'd been the groom, but anyway, I'm talking about religion. When we say religion, there are, of course, two very different meanings that we attach to that word, aren't there? When people think religion in the institutional sense, organized religion, the church, capital C, their attitudes to it in Australia and in comparable Western countries, their attitudes tend to be negative. They tend to think of the institutional church, particularly the Roman Catholic and to a lesser extent Anglican churches, as being powerful, corrupt, prescriptive, exclusive, and of course all the child sexual abuse stuff that's emerged in the Royal Commission has only made those negative attitudes worse. But when you say religion, if people think not an institution but the faith of an individual religious believer, attitudes are very different. And even people who have no religious faith are inclined to admire the religious faith of others. In fact, in some of the research I was doing for this new book, I came to think that there's a phenomenon called faith envy, which is quite widespread in Australia, of people who don't have any religious faith but kind of wish they did, or they used to and they've lost it and they wish they could get it back but they can't, or their parents have it and they don't, or they've just met someone who seems to be animated by very, very compassionate, charitable impulses and they wish they could be like that as well. Well, when you look at the situation in Australia, it would be tempting, of course, to say, well, clearly religion is on the way out. If this graph has descended so steeply, there's only one place for it to end up, and that's at point zero. Well, anyone who drew that conclusion, I think, would be missing not only the lessons of history, but the lessons of psychology as well. Religion survives in every culture. It waxes and wanes. At the moment, for example, in Scandinavia, it's waning even more than it is here. Scandinavia has the lowest rate of church attendance in the world. But it comes and goes. And by the way, in Scandinavia, where there used to be a church tax, which everybody was compelled to pay to support the state church, when the church was disestablished and there was no longer a state church, the church tax was retained but made voluntary. Do you know what happened? The vast majority of Scandinavians still voluntarily pay the church tax, like the people who want the church in their neighborhood, even if they don't want to go. But religion always survives and will survive in every culture because of what it offers people. And not just better health, although there are some very persuasive statistics showing a very positive correlation between religious faith and practice and lower blood pressure, less incidence of cardiovascular disease, lower rates of depression and quicker bounce back from depression. It's quite impressive until you learn that roughly the same correlations exist between all those health benefits and pet ownership. So we don't want to take this too seriously. But much of the health benefit that derives from religious faith and practice is, of course, to do as much with the sense of belonging to a close-knit, mutually supportive faith community as it is to do with the particular beliefs that might be shared or not shared by the members of that community. In other words, one of the enduring sources of religion's power is the power of the tribe. The fact that when we attach ourselves to a particular church, denomination, local congregation, whatever it might be, we are tapping into a tribal phenomenon, the dynamics of a tribal movement from which we derive enormous psychological, emotional, and spiritual benefits. But it's not only the tribe. Religion will always endure because of the power of faith itself. Faith can move mountains, we're told. Well, of course, faith can't move mountains, but faith certainly can move people to do all sorts of extraordinary things. If you doubt the power of faith, then just step aside from religion for a moment and think about, in the medical context, the famous placebo effect. I'm sure you're aware of the placebo effect, but let me just briefly describe what I'm talking about. In a clinical trial of a new drug, good medical researchers will always draw two matched samples of people who are in need of the drug, who have the problem that the drug is designed to address. And they agree to take part in an experiment in which it's explained to them that half of them will receive the drug, and the other half will receive a placebo, which is just an inert substance, an empty capsule or a piece of chalk in the shape of a tablet or whatever. No therapeutic properties at all. And in study after study, hundreds of studies of this kind of clinical trial, a persistent 30% of the people who are swallowing the placebo report the therapeutic benefits that they expect to get from the drug. In other words, if they believe they're taking the drug, then in 30% of cases that can actually have a therapeutic effect. The most dramatic therapeutic effect I've encountered was a very respectable study. It was published in the New England Medical Journal. And by the way, before I go any further, if you've recently had an arthroscopy on a knee, just block your ears, don't listen to this story. Because the study was undertaken on a group of patients who were scheduled to have an arthroscopy. I don't know how this was ever approved by any authority, but anyway, it was. They did the study. Half the patient, the patients were told that they had only a 50% chance of an arthroscopy. Everyone was going to have an incision in the skin, and then some were going to have the arthroscopy and then be sewn up, and others were just going to be sewn up. No arthroscopy. Well, I'm sure you can guess the results. The researchers reported that there was no statistically significant difference in pain relief or knee function between those who'd had the operation and those who'd just had the incision in the skin. So let's not be skeptical about the concept of faith healing. We can do it to ourselves. Let's not be skeptical about the power of faith to produce extraordinary outcomes in human life. Now, let's move from medicine back to religion. Obviously, religion gives a particular focus to faith. And the faith that religion offers people is the sort of faith that gives a rich sense of meaning and purpose to people's lives. Martin Seligman, the leader of the positive psychology movement, you may have read some of his work, Learned Optimism, I think was his most famous book. But Seligman and some of his research colleagues have been publishing for years research that leads them to the conclusion that the one essential condition for people to have a strong sense of meaning and purpose in their lives is that they should have placed their faith in something greater than themselves. Now, Seligman is not arguing in favor of religion. He's not saying the something greater than yourself must be God. But it might be God, it might be an institution, it might be the nation, it might be the family, it might be the idea of justice, it might be faith in the power of love to transform individuals and relationships and society, whatever it might be. Some people place their faith in science or music. There are some people who place their faith in the free market. There, no doubt. Some people, of course, place their faith in leaders and are inevitably and always disappointed. But faith in something greater than ourselves, and of course, for people whose faith is grounded in some set of religious principles or beliefs, that effect is demonstrable. The third thing that more or less guarantees the survival of religion is the huge cultural power of those grand religious narratives that exist in every religious context. Now, I don't want to offend anyone in the room when I say this, but obviously some people look at those stories and say, that's the literal historical truth. The world was created in 7 days. Or Mary actually was a virgin when she conceived the baby that became Jesus. Or Jesus did literally rise from the dead and was seen by people in a post-resurrection form. Now, there are many people, millions of people, who literally believe those things to be true. But there are millions of other people who are utterly engaged by those stories, not because they think they are historical truth, but because they are moved by the metaphorical power of those stories. They're responding not to the truth of the story, but the truth in the story. For example, many of the miracles said to have been performed by Jesus. Again, some people will say, that's literally what happened. There were 5,000 people who needed to be fed, and there was a little boy, and he had 2 fish and 5 loaves, and Jesus distributed this, and 5,000 people were fed. Well, Some people will say that's literally the case, and other people will say that's not the point of the story at all. The story is metaphorical. It's a story about the multiplier effect of love, of compassion. That when we are generous, when we are kind, when we are compassionate towards others, it just keeps on, the ripples go out and it keeps multiplying, and one lunch can feed 5,000 people, metaphorically speaking. Well, whether you take the metaphorical or the literal approach is entirely up to you, but either way, these grand narratives do have the power to inspire people in all sorts of ways. J.S. Bach, arguably the greatest composer in the Western canon, dedicated every note he ever composed to the glory of God. He was moved by all of those stories. People are encouraged, people are motivated, people in the fields of social justice in particular are often specifically moved by the narratives in the West, the narratives of both the Old and New Testament. But also, of course, for many people, those narratives supply answers to existential questions that would otherwise be unanswerable, like why are we here, what's it all for, perhaps even what might happen when this ends. I want to just read a sentence or two from late in the book that captures the point I've just been making, and then I'll quickly wrap this up. Religion has protected the sanity of millions of people. Its comforts and consolations, theological, social, and emotional, have relieved countless generations of their existential anxiety and encouraged them to live noble rather than merely moral lives. It has saved them from despair and given them hope. So why wouldn't religion survive when it does all of that? And of course it does it all most particularly for people who are in distress, for people who are marginalised, disadvantaged. The highest rate of church attendance in the world at the moment is in Nigeria. Not very surprising. Nigeria doesn't just top the league table for church attendance, but also infant mortality, illiteracy, all the measures of a society in trouble. Nigeria tends to top the list. Is it any surprise that religion does so well there? In Ireland, which once had the highest rate of church attendance in Europe, when Ireland joined the EU and had a huge injection of capital, and became, as you will recall, the tiger economy of Europe, church attendance fell away. Now that Ireland is back to being a bit of an economic basket case, they've all gone back to church. And once again, Ireland has the highest rate of church attendance in Europe. When people are suffering, when a society is in trouble, that's when religion tends to thrive. So look at Australia. Let me just mention a few things about Australia. 2 million Australians are currently suffering from an anxiety disorder. 1 million Australians are currently suffering from depression. Societies, neighbourhoods, families are more fragmented in Australia than they've ever been in our history. Australia is suffering an epidemic of obesity. 2/3 of us are overweight, and 30% of us are actually obese. Between 65,000 and 70,000 Australians attempt suicide every year. Between 65,000 and 70,000. Almost 1 million dependent kids in Australia are living in poverty. 16% of Australian children lack secure access to sufficient, safe, nutritious food. Roughly 2 million Australians are either unemployed or significantly underemployed. 100,000 Australians are homeless. 2 million Australian women have been victims of domestic violence. 500,000 Australian men have been victims of domestic violence. The Economist magazine ran a survey a few years ago on rates of serious assault in all the countries in the world that gather statistics on rates of serious assault, guess who was top of the list? The highest rate of serious assault in the world? Australia. And we know we're suffering at the moment from a problem of galloping income inequality. Now, that's a slightly depressing little list I've just read out, but I mention it to say this is a society in trouble. This is a society in which many people are wounded, damaged, disorientated, disadvantaged. You would think this was a society ripe for a return to religion, but there's no sign that that is the case. In fact, as I've mentioned, the trend is moving inexorably in the opposite direction. So why, in a country with as many social, economic, cultural problems as we have, we can't even work out marriage equality in a simple way. Why in a country like this would religion have been in such sharp decline? Of course, it's not in universal decline. Pentecostalism is thriving, the Hillsong phenomenon and its various manifestations, of which there are many around Adelaide, of course, booming. And some of the traditional Roman Catholic and Anglican cathedrals are also experiencing growing attendance. I think that those two forms of religious worship are at opposite ends of the spectrum, really, except the thing they have in common is theatre, an experience, whether in the case of the cathedrals, it's banners and processions and incense and ethereal music, or in the case of Pentecostalists, a lot of swooning and rock music. In fact, a friend of mine went to Hillsong not long ago to experience for himself what the phenomenon, how do they get 10,000 people there every Sunday? And he said he experienced hearing loss for 3 days as a result of the exuberance of the occasion. Well, there are those exceptions. The general picture is the one I've been describing. So why? Why such a decline over the past 50 years in particular? Let me quickly suggest three major factors which I think are the explanation for this. The first is that under the influence of what we now tend to call neoliberalism, the particular form of capitalism that we're living with at the moment, we have been subjected to a lot of propaganda that feeds the idea that we are individuals rather than members of a community, and that it's a very competitive world. And that as individuals, we have to fight for our own survival, for our own prosperity, for our own security, and so on. Now, that propaganda associated with the rise of the me culture has come particularly from two directions which are very different, but lead to the same conclusion. One is from the world of consumer mass marketing, which has always said, but now it's getting better and better at saying it, that you're all entitled to wealth, prosperity, material comfort, and that you should define yourself in terms of the amount of stuff you've acquired. So keep buying stuff and you'll feel better and better. And if you've run out of money and you still don't feel terrific, well, we can give you a magic piece of plastic which will allow you to keep on buying stuff beyond the point where you can afford it in the pursuit of this consumerist nirvana. And our record levels of personal debt at the moment are a testament to just how effective that propaganda has been. But there's another form of propaganda pushing us in the same general direction, and that's the propaganda that's come from what I've come to think of as the happiness industry. The people who've been selling us the idea that the default position for humans is to be happy. That if you're not happy, there's something wrong with you, so get happy. Attend one of our conferences or buy one of our books or watch one of our TED Talks. And if all that fails, we have pharmacological pathways to happiness, not all of them legal, which will get you into the state that we suggest you should be in. Is it any wonder that at the time when there's been such a push in the direction of promising happiness to people, that the rise of illicit recreational drug use should have been so dramatic, especially among the young? A shortcut to the thing we're being promised. Well, it's all rubbish, of course. Whoever dreamed up the idea that we're all meant to be happy? By the way, I'm not against happiness. I enjoy being happy in those occasional moments when it visits me. I finished a book about a week ago, and I permitted myself about 20 minutes of absolute euphoria. And then it was just get on with whatever has to be done. That's how happiness is. It visits us occasionally. We usually realize we were happy after we stopped being happy. And the reason for that is that we are, as humans, blessed with a full spectrum of emotions for helping us to cope with whatever life throws at us. And every point on the spectrum is vital to our understanding of what it means to be human. And no point on the spectrum would make sense without the context of all the others. If I could bestow on you tonight the promise of perpetual happiness forevermore, I can guarantee that you would never again be happy. Because you've got to be sad to know what happiness is. You've got to have failed to know what success is. That's the beauty of the human condition. There's all this light and shade. There are all these contrasts, and we need them all to give us a sense of what it really means to be human. But the happiness push, the happiness propaganda, has certainly got us in its grip. And put that together with the materialist message from the consumer mass marketing industry, both very sophisticated messages saying it's all about me and it's all about my prosperity and my happiness. So that message is very powerful, and it's turned out to be very seductive, and of course it's antithetical to the message of any of the world's great religions, certainly including Christianity. It's as though there's a contest in which people are being offered the choice. Would you rather be rich and happy, or kind and compassionate and perhaps a little self-sacrificial? Well, some people would be saying, could I have both? Well, it's hard to have both. But if that's the contest, then it's a contest that individualism and materialism have been winning over religion. But there are a couple of other reasons why religion has been in decline. And one, of course, is the behavior of religious institutions. One reason why people have turned away from Christian churches is that those churches have behaved very badly. And I'm not just talking about child sexual abuse, although that's certainly been a dramatic trigger for many people to leave the institutional church. But it's not just that. It's not just corruption. It's not just a perception of too much wealth. It's also that many people have left their local church because it was too boring, because they thought it was irrelevant. They couldn't connect what they were hearing with the experience of their own life. Or they felt it was a bit too exclusive. They felt as though they were never really embraced. They felt as though they were being judged, or perhaps having their intelligence insulted by what was happening. Or, particularly if they were women, they might have felt that this institution never seems to have heard about the women's movement. Did they not know there was a gender revolution? How could they possibly go on with this sort of male supremacist stuff that they do? And the third explanation, to my mind, is that in a highly educated Western society like ours, where levels of skepticism are very high, traditional religious demands to sign up to a whole set of doctrines, dogma, beliefs, has become less and less possible for people who are saying that collides with my sense of reason, particularly the literal interpretation of Scripture defies reason. I'm attracted to the Sermon on the Mount, I'm attracted to the parables, I'm attracted to teachings about how we ought to be loving each other more than we do, we ought to be kinder, more compassionate, more respectful to each other. I like all of that, but now you're going to tell me if I'm going to be a Christian, I've also got to believe virgin birth, resurrection, whatever it might be, well, sorry, I draw the line. So people who think of religious faith as something that would be dynamic and evolving and constantly battling with doubt are often just turned off by people within a religious institution who say, no, this is the pathway to absolute certainty, and perhaps the smugness and even the arrogance that goes with that. Well, my time is up, more or less. 2 minutes, I think I have. So in the last 2 minutes, I want to share with you an impression I have. I'm not now speaking as a researcher proving a case. I'm speaking of an impression that I have of what's going on in the wake of everything that I've been describing. And then we can have some conversation about this. I think there's a quiet revolution going on, both within the church and outside the church. And it seems to me that the effect of this revolution long term will be to bring people who think of themselves as atheists and people who think of themselves as theists much closer together in the future. The revolution for many Christians began, or the effect of it, the thing that produced the revolution, began towards the end of the 19th century with Friedrich Nietzsche saying that God is dead. Now, we won't go into Nietzsche. He was a very eccentric philosopher, and people are still trying to figure out whether he was serious when he said that and many other things, and half of the stuff that he wrote was on scraps of paper discovered after his death, all of that. However, when Nietzsche said God is dead, that resonated right through the 20th century. Now, of course, what Nietzsche was saying was not there was once a God out there that was alive and now it's dead. What Nietzsche was saying was the idea of an external entity, an almighty, judgmental, creating God that has had Western imagination in its grip for all these centuries, no longer has the same grip on Western imagination. The idea of God as the author of human morality no longer has Western Europe in its grip. And of course, he was right. In the wake of the Enlightenment, that was true. That idea of God had lost its grip. But that did not mean that people just abandoned God. What it did mean is that within Christian theology, throughout the 20th century, there was a gradual shift away from that idea, though many people, I acknowledge, including no doubt some here, still believe very firmly in that traditional idea of an external God as an entity. But the move more generally seems to have been towards something far more internal. The sort of thing that Carl Jung, the psychoanalyst, was talking about in the 30s when he wrote, and he was a Christian himself, but he wrote about the God within. He was talking about the spirit of love within us and among us, which is, on some readings of the New Testament, a very New Testament way of thinking about God, not as a thing or a being, but as a spirit. And what kind of spirit? The spirit of love and kindness and compassion. So I think that's a very quiet but very significant revolution that's happening. But then there's another aspect to the revolution which I pick up when I listen to people completely outside the church talking about their attitude to spirituality. I was talking to a young bloke as part of the research I did for the book, and in the course of the conversation he said to me, by the way, I'm an SBNR. Being a good researcher, I just nodded. Yeah. Oh, yeah, all my friends are SBNRs. In the census, we tick no religion, but we write in SBNR. So eventually I weakened and said, what is SBNR? Spiritual, but not religious. And so I had an interesting conversation with him, and I've been having interesting conversations with people ever since who say, yes, I think I'm an SBNR. And what they're saying is, I'm not attracted at all to institutional religion, but don't write me off as a mere materialist. I still want to acknowledge and nurture the spiritual dimension of my life. I just don't think that the church is a place where that's likely to happen. And listening to SBNRs talking, I typically hear them describing two light bulb moments. One is, I suddenly realized that we are all one. We're all part of the same deal. The difference between you and me is interesting, but not nearly as significant as the fact that we're in it together. We're, We're almost indivisible. Second light bulb moment, therefore, the only appropriate way to treat each other is kindly and with compassion and with respect, even towards those whom we don't like much, even towards those with whom we could never agree, but they're us too. And if they're us too, then what they deserve is our love, our respect, our kindness, our compassion. Now, when I hear people talking about all that, and I hear Christians talking about their faith and what it does for them, I seem to be hearing the same stuff. It seems to me that from both those two very different directions, we are moving towards a deeper understanding of the fact that that is the essential truth about humans, that we are social beings who need each other, and we need constant encouragement, whether it comes from religion or from some other source. We need constant encouragement, spine-stiffening messages that will remind us that the only appropriate way to treat each other is lovingly, kindly, and with compassion. It's very hard to find someone who would disagree with that. It turns out that all the squabbles are about doctrine. All the squabbles are about belief. It's a wonder we haven't all become Unitarians. But by the time I'd finished writing this book, I must say I'd lost interest in people's beliefs. It seemed to me that that much deeper truth than any particular doctrine was the thing that we need to embrace. And the question I would always ask someone now is not, what do you believe, but what do you put your faith in? Thank you.